Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, on location, just about wrapping up what is the most challenging documentary of my career, 7 years in production, and just finished filming up in Canada, one of the more important voices in the environmental movement. Later today, I'll give you a little bit of insight into what he had to say and who he is and why it matters, and because he's not being listened to in the United States, and he should be. He should be listened to worldwide. Off to film in Australia, Dr. Helen Caldicott, because we have avoided looking at Fukushima. It's still there and still polluting, and yet they're trying to say that it's decontaminated enough to start moving people right back near there. It isn't decontaminated. So, and then a couple more people out in Seattle, and we're finished. Look forward to premiering this as a fundraiser for our sister station, WBAI in New York, sometime later this summer. Today, you're going to hear from Glenn Greenwald on Join Assange. You're also going to hear my guest in the second part of our program, Joe Loria. Joe is an outstanding independent investigative journalist. He covers international affairs and the editor of and chief of Consortium News. That's a very important progressive news site covering both domestic and foreign affairs. It was actually started by the late journalist Robert Perry. And for 25 years, he was the United Nations correspondent covering major world crises, the first Gulf War, the breakup of Yugoslavia, the invasion of Iraq. In 7 of those years, he was also with the Wall Street Journal and also the Boston Globe and the Sunday Times of London and Montreal Gazette and German Press. So you're going to hear from him, and we're going to talk about the arrest of Assange and how it's a threat to the freedom of the press. Also today, I'm going to do two commentaries. One is on the environment, and I hope that you share my insights with the different legislators, including Representative Cortez, of how they should redefine the Green New Deal to make it more plausible and to break it into segments. There are some parts of it that are simply not realistic and are actually anti-environmental. I'll explain that. I fully support their enthusiasm and desire to see something happen. But in the real world, we have to do something that is science-based, humanistically principled, and has a plausible opportunity to actually succeed. None of the above apply to the current model. Also today, I'll be going in greater depth on one aspect of the environment, a commentary on what is the likely outcome of all of our efforts worldwide. So that's our show, a lot to cover. I won't be taking calls today, but I just want to thank the people who have been calling in. I'll get to your calls next week. And just let the people overseas know, in all the countries around the world that are listening, that on Zeno Radio, and that's about 16 or so thousand different stations, we're number one. And we beat Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh and Tom Hart. We beat them all. We're the number one searched progressive radio station in the world. My program alone has clocked past 100 million individual downloads and growing. So thank you for supporting our messages and sharing them with others. And by the way, if Wikipedia thought that there would not be a formidable response to all the slanders and character assassination they've engaged in with me and other people, we have a few people joining us. Not many, but those who count. How about 77,000 chiropractors and their 35 million patients? Well, you ought to see the energy behind that. And Next week, I'll be doing part two of the war against chiropractic. It continues today on Wikipedia. So we are gaining in the challenge to the supposed platforms that are supposed to be neutral but are not, and we're challenging all these platforms, but specifically Wikipedia, to have its IRS tax-exempt status rescinded because of its gross and multiple violations. All of those we have detailed to the Inspector General of the IRS and every member of Congress, and every one of the 50 state attorney generals. You'll see it's already out there, and there's all kinds of actions being taken. If you'd like to listen to any of our programs on the archive, please write down this number, 701-719-9976, 701-719-9976. To the latest on health and healing, just a little shorter version than normal because we have so many other things to cover today. And by the way, please take as many notes as you can today. I'm going to tell you, I'm going to share a lot. But we start with Oxford University. They took a look at 500,000 adults, and they wanted to know, does eating fresh fruit lower your risk of a heart attack or a stroke? How about that? Yes, it does. According to Oxford University, people who eat fresh fruits on most days are at the lower risk of a heart attack or a stroke than people who rarely eat fresh fruit. And this was published in the current issue of the New England Journal of Medicine. This was a 7-year study, 500,000 adults, and those who ate the most fruit had the least amount of heart attacks and strokes. You know that. Many of you have increased the amount of fruits and hopefully vegetables in your diet. Why? Because you're getting potassium. We know magnesium is the single most important mineral to prevent a heart attack or stroke or irregular heartbeat, but potassium's right beside it. Then you have in your dietary fibers, then your antioxidants, and then various other compounds, and it's low in sodium and low in fat or non-existent in fat, very few calories. So if it's apples or oranges or grapefruits or kiwis or limes, papaya, mango, eat them all. That'll lower your blood pressure, lower your blood glucose, help you prevent a heart attack, soften up your arteries, improve turning off inflammation in your blood. And it's only 100 grams per day. That's about 3 ounces. That's not even a half a cup. That's not a lot. And that will lessen your risk by 1/3 of dying from a cardiovascular event. That is terrific news. So one more on our side, the vegan healthy selection side. Now, of course, that competes against statins and taking that stupid aspirin each day and all the other things they're telling you. But this is real non-toxic and it works. From the John Innes Center in the United Kingdom comes a study showing how a Chinese medicinal plant makes anti-cancer compounds. So this is new research led by Professor Kathy Martin at the center that's revealed how a plant that is used on a regular basis, has been used for a long time, helps to treat cancer and liver diseases both. It's the Chinese skullcap, skull, S-K-U-L-L-C-A-P. It's also called Sucteliera, and it's also known in Chinese medicine as Huangqin, H-U-A-N-G-Q-I-N. If you have a fever, if you have liver and lung complaints, they use it. And previous research on cells cultured in the lab has shown that certain compounds called flavones, F-L-A-V-O-N-E-S, found in the roots of this plant, not only have beneficial antiviral and antioxidant effects, but they can also kill human cancers. But they leave all your other cells alone, untouched. And these flavones have also halted tumor growth, and that's important. So you've heard me mention many times that the flavones are not well understood, but they're extremely beneficial, and they should be in our diet on a more regular basis. Many flavones are synthesized using a compound called naringenin, and it's a building block, and that's part of what they're finding of how to work with these natural compounds to block cancer and to kill cancer cells. So the next time you look on Wikipedia and it downplays and denigrates and calls nonsense traditional Chinese medicine used on tens of billions of people over the millennia and in great textbooks and then confirmed not just historically but now in modern state-of-the-art labs, equaling and surpassing any lab we had in the United States. So they're just on the wrong side of history and the wrong side of truth. From the Danish Cancer Society's Research Center, it once again shows that a low selenium level, which is not good, increases your prostate cancer risk. So we need to have more selenium-rich foods, or just 200 micrograms selenium, that's a small amount, into the diet each day. And this was a part of the look at 27,179 men over a period of time and found that this is a common denominator. You need vitamin E and selenium because it can make a difference. And they're suggesting vitamin E at a relatively small dose. I would go probably 500 units a day. And that's important. Broccoli could counter obesity-related liver disease. This University of Illinois. So quite simply adding broccoli or broccoli sprouts to an unhealthy diet could help stave off obesity-related liver disease because they generally go hand in hand. Because if you're on an unhealthy diet and you're overweight, the likelihood is you have a non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, and that's a killer. And it's almost always linked to obesity. So this study reports that simply adding broccoli to a high-fat, high-sugar Western lifestyle diet could block the development of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And this was published in the journal Nutrition. So let's just be realistic about this for a moment. In my own family, of my brothers and mother, father, all my aunts and uncles, I had no ability to help any of them change anything at any time ever. Not that I didn't try. We had many arguments around the dinner table, but they would just laugh at me. And growing up, and unfortunately, they all died young. They didn't have to, but their belief system is what ultimately caused their death. Yeah, it was the alcohol, and it was the 3 to 4 packs smoking a day, thinking that was normal, and it was not exercising and not dealing with stress appropriately. Those all contributed, but it was the fact that they felt they couldn't be different. They couldn't be healthy, because anyone who was different where I grew up was considered the oddball. Something was wrong with that person. So I know that many of you have suffered similarly, where you just couldn't get common sense, reason, and even good science to help someone that you care about. But if you just got them to do one thing, and that would be to take broccoli and get it into their diet, then maybe that could make a difference. Not a whole difference, not change everything. A, they wouldn't allow that. But any suffering that we can lessen another human being is still worth it. So that's the latest on health and healing. We're 15 minutes into our program. We're going to take a break and come back, and I'm going to share a couple of commentaries with you. So please stay with us.
Shadow by the
I fully support the efforts of any conscientious effort to improve our awareness of environmental factors that are impacting us and to change those. But we have to also be realistic. Haven't we lived the last at least 40 years with platitudes, charming personalities, and people who said that our interests were their interest? All of that was nice. None of it changed anything for the better. And now one of the movements is to let's get people more aware that we've got 12 years to make major changes or it's all over. We don't have 12 years. We have far less. In the fact, ask the people in Colorado, where in one town they had 104-mile-an-hour winds yesterday, dumped 2 feet of snow, and some of that was put into orchards where there was already blossoming because it had gone up to 70 degrees earlier. They had a 50-degree drop in a matter of hours. Tell that to the cows or the new babies coming in the spring that died. Tell that to the million animals that died in Missouri just 3 weeks ago. What are you going to do to those farmers? The entire farming in the state was devastated, and yet it's no longer in a news cycle, so it's forgotten. So these are events happening right now, not in the future. But one of the platforms that they're using is, to get all fossil fuel, we have to go to nuclear. That's not true. Nuclear is one of the most seriously dangerous forms of energy production there is. They should have put their energy into, let's develop our completely untapped and unused geothermal. We have geothermal streams all over the United States, not just Yellowstone Basin, but all throughout the Southwest in Arkansas, Alabama, out west in California. That has been used in Iceland to heat its roads and homes and highways. There's a lot of uses for it. And also wave power. We don't have to create wind turbines that already are archaic, and there's a boneyard of these around the United States where they've killed hundreds of millions of birds, caused noise pollution, and generally never pay back what it costs to put them in energy saved later on. They're now bladeless wind turbines that you could put on the top of your home that will supply just in the home enough to run most of your power. But the waves that completely surround the United States, that is an endless supply of energy that you're not going to see it. There's one even in the Hudson River, right near Ellis Island. So the ones we should be focusing on, we're not. But we're focusing on nuclear. Let me explain why nuclear is a disaster. First of all, nuclear waste. The waste generated by nuclear reactors remains radioactive for tens to hundreds of thousands of years, and there is no long-term storage solutions for radioactive waste. All of the places they wanted to store it, it was found that one was on a earthquake fault zone that was active. Well, that doesn't work. And so they keep these spent fuel rods, which are not depleted, they're just less than what they were when they were in the active reactor inside, but they're stored outside, sometimes thousands. That's a problem. If you don't have any place to put the waste of what you're creating, just imagine this. Just imagine, because I actually saw this in Naples, Italy, what happens when there's a strike and nobody picks up your garbage? Now imagine that nobody picked up any garbage in any city, on any street, from any house or building for 50 years. You wouldn't have a community you could live in. That's the problem you have with nuclear. There's no place to safely store it. Also, look at national security. Nuclear power plants are a potential target for terrorist operations. And right now, the next terrorist attack, the major ones, are going to be on the grid. Think of the enemies now or in the future who have realized they could never beat America with our submarines and warships and planes and tanks and any of the conventional weaponry and people we have, we would win. But what happens if they could, through cybersecurity breaches, go in and take out all the electrical systems so that no electrical system on an airplane would be able to function? All those planes would fall out of the sky. Now think of all the homes where you wouldn't have heat or cold, television, internet, radio. Now think of what would happen if that also occurs when you're on a working in a nuclear facility. A nuclear facility has only about 1 week to 4 weeks maximum backup energy. So once that energy is gone, the entire plant explodes. And you therefore take all of the contained spent fuel rod energy and all in the plant itself, and you spew it into the air. Everyone within 50 miles, within 2 hours to 3 hours, be contaminated. And within a week of that occurring, the whole area would never be habitable in history, ever again in your lifetimes. Now imagine that you could hack the electrical systems. Even with new artificial intelligence, it could do that. And that could be something done inside the United States. So you see, you're dealing with an enormously complex situation. Also, nuclear power could be adversely affected at the research facilities, at the uranium enrichment plants, at the uranium mines, and also accidents. This has not been a blemish-free situation. You've had Chernobyl. You've had Three Mile Island. In fact, go on my site, please, prn.fm. Download the article that Dr. Ernest Sternglass and Dr. Jay Gould and myself, we wrote it with all the graphs showing 50,000 babies died downwind of Three Mile Island. We used the government's own statistics, and once our article came out, the next day, all those statistics were erased. All of them. They covered it up. Now look at Fukushima and look at the devastation. That was all due to human error and natural disasters. Then look at the cancer risk. Significant risk of cancer is associated with fallout from radioactive leaks. If you live within 20 miles of a nuclear facility, you have a much higher incidence of breast cancer for your women if you have no other risk factors. Because when they close down, we show that that cancer risk dropped way down. So there's cause and effect there. We also see that workers are at a higher risk of death from cancer at a rate similar to that of Japanese nuclear bomb survivors. We know that children are at greater risk of leukemia. Then you have energy production. It's not clean energy. That's wrong information. And it would require many more plants to meet future energy needs. And uranium is energy intensive to mine and polluting, and it leaves large carbon footprint. So think of it this way. In order to create cleaner energy, you're creating dirty energy. And they're never looking at that side of the equation. It's just like your cell phones. Do you realize how much goes into exploiting the people in order to have a particular metal that is used in your cell phones? Well, if you take that into equation, then it's not such a great deal. It's no different than if you say, I just bought a great outfit. I bought a great dress or jacket, pants. Mm-hmm. What made it great? Well, you know, they're normally $150. I got them for $75. That's good. Where were they made? Why? Well, if they were made in Bangladesh, those women are forced to work at as little as 14 to 28 cents an hour. And they have the shortest work lifespan in the world, 33 years of age. So is having a woman work themselves to death under terrible conditions, is that justifiable so you can buy a pair of pants or a dress? 900 million of those outfits were sold in the United States last year. So we're only 333 million people, so that's three outfits for every man, woman, and child. And that's just from one country. That didn't even include Haiti and India and China. So understand something. There's a cost to this. the water threats. Do you realize that for every nuclear power plant generator, it takes 1 billion gallons of water every 24 hours? That creates enormously hot water where it is discharged back into the, like the Hudson River, causing hundreds of millions of fish to die per year, or into the ocean, where it's also taken. Now, that makes it susceptible to droughts, flooding, hurricanes, earthquakes, and other potential disasters that could trigger nuclear accident. And the cost, unlike renewables, nuclear costs are increasing, and capital costs and fuel maintenance and costs are much higher for nuclear plants than wind. On the other hand, the price of renewable energy has fallen significantly and is projected to continue to fall, and that's good. And competition with renewables, investment in nuclear plants and security and mining infrastructure, taking about 12 years from the time you begin to complete one, that draws funding away from investment in cleaner sources like solar, geothermal, and wave. And just be realistic, there's a horrible track record. Past history has shown that energy companies controlling nuclear power plants have been extraordinarily negligent in meeting environmental standards. They cover up leaks. They fail in complying with regulations. So it's the one thing we don't need. Please pass that on to the people who are trying to get things done but don't realize there's a right and an inaccurate way of getting them done. Now, I want to go to my second extension of this, and that is I want to share with you the likely climate change events occurring right now as we speak, but because they're not all occurring at the same time and because they're not all causing, let's say, regions of the world to collapse simultaneously. That never happens. It's all pieces. And those who are able financially and with flexibility can move out of harm's way. Most people will not be able to do that. So science is quite conclusive that climate change is boosting the extremity and frequency of weather events. On Monday, I'll be challenging Tucker Carlson and his guest, talking about how, well, Syria had a drought, but then they did a study and found out they actually didn't have such a drought, and therefore all this migration scare isn't real. And yeah, yes, it is. And that's the trouble with having someone on your staff that does just enough research off of some, the Heartland Institute, or someone else that is denying global warming to make people feel comfortable in not making change or being aware of it versus doing real scholarship research, which can give you a much more honest perspective. So here we are. The jet stream in the moderate zone, that is between the equator and the North Pole, is now destabilizing. It's increasingly wobbling. And that disrupts regular seasons and contributes to dramatic extremes in temperature and weather events. We've seen the Arctic vortex. We didn't even know what the Arctic vortex was 10 years ago. We never heard of it because it never happened. Now it's happening two or three times a year, including in times of the year when it should never happen. It happened yesterday. And it happened a month before that, over the whole Northeast and Midwest. So that can also impact crop growing seasons and pollinator behavior. You have an Arctic vortex that hits the bees, they'll kill them all. And on top of that are all the pesticides. And the pesticides and the neonicotinoids are not being regulated. Why? Because, once again, go to one of the problems. All of our major regulatory agencies have been captured by technocrats who are highly educated, more often than not, most are, and who are all now policymakers for the hidden hand of the corporate agenda. I gave you the example of Michael Taylor. Michael Taylor on the left, well, that's the man working for the FDA and oversight of making sure companies don't go rogue on health standards. Michael Taylor on the left, chief lawyer for Monsanto, and then going back and forth between the two. That's one of about 7,000 examples of people leaving one agency as a policymaker, like Judy Gerberling, who was head of the CDC, and then going to work for Merck, and then getting millions of dollars in options, and then going back into corporate America or back in the government. Whose interests do these people serve? In the environment, they never serve the environment or the people affected by it. So here we have the jet stream. So you're not going to have crops growing where they once did. You will not have pollinator behavior. And insect and bird migrations are being devastated as insects are being destroyed. So what we are already experiencing will worsen. Here's what's going to get worse, never better, in your lifetime. The continual rise in temperature with less uniformity. Frost-free seasons will lengthen, affecting agriculture and ecosystems. The radical changes in precipitation patterns mean we'll have so much water coming down in a given area that it floods everything. We're seeing that now in Illinois and Indiana and in northern Arkansas. The rise in droughts and heat waves, the most dangerous being in central United States in our grain belt, the place where that grain is grown will no longer in the future and now be able to grow it as easily as it did in the past. Stronger and more intense hurricanes. Frequently, we're going to have 2 to 3, even 4, Category 4 or 5 hurricanes per year. In Florida, we haven't even recovered from one a year and a half ago. Storms will increase the rate of coastal erosion and contribute to rising sea levels, especially on the Atlantic side. And we're going to see the increase in prevalence of insect-borne diseases and their spread into warming areas. You already can see this. If you fly on a plane that's flying lower, the entire eastern seaboard, from Florida through Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, right up through to Maine, you'll see massive destruction of forest. Those are beetles. That's from hot weather. You're going to see depressed crop yields as soils become increasingly stressed, lower quality of life. In developing countries, you'll see a rise in starvation. You'll see far more poverty in urban areas. Because when you can't grow crops where you'd grown it throughout your life in the country, you'll move to the city. But you don't have the money to live in the city, so you'll live in the poor suburbs or the urban ghettos, and then you're just going to be another migrant, forgotten, and a refugee. You'll start to see a life expectancy decrease around much of the world. Now, NASA's predictions show that the Northeast, you're going to have more heat waves, heavier rainfall, and sea level rise. The Northwest, that includes, by the way, Oregon and the southwestern part of Canada, you're going to see into Washington State and Northern California, you're going to see stream flow changes, which will reduce water supplies. You're going to have massive drought. You're going to have where you once had lush forests. You're going to have more wildfires, insect outbreaks, and forest diseases. You're going to see the Southeast, especially in the Carolinas, in Georgia, in Florida. You're going to see sea level rise, extreme hurricanes, extreme heat waves, agricultural stress, decrease in water availability. In the Midwest, and we're talking about 16 states bordering the Midwest, and the Midwest itself, extreme heat and extreme drought interspersed with extreme rainfall and flooding, affecting infrastructure and health and agriculture and ecosystems and water quality. I predict that within the next 5 years, 80% of all small farming in the Midwest will be so challenged that people will be bankrupt or getting out. You'll see another great dust bowl, but it won't be a dust bowl like we had in the 30s. It'll be different. It'll be because of severe drought and no help. And then in the Southwest, you're talking about Arizona, Nevada, South Dakota, half of California, 80% of Texas, Oklahoma, Colorado. You're going to see increased heat waves and droughts, insect outbreaks, rise in wildfires, reduced crop yields, declining water resources. Now, that's important you remember these things because it also tells you for the future the best places to live and the places least likely to live. Now, that gets to another issue. And this is the final one before we take a break and go to our guest. With all the people I've spoken with, including I filmed up in Canada, Dr. David Suzuki, and he is one of the world's greatest environmentalists and also a historian on, he has a background in so many of the sciences. And just today he said, quote, This came just this morning from his Suzuki Foundation, that's S-U-Z-U-K-I. Rapid warming deserves more than a lukewarm response. Quote, another week, another dramatic warming, a warning from scientists met with shrugs all around. This time, a report commissioned by the Environmental and Climate Change Canada, Canada's Changing Climate Report, warned that this country is warming at roughly twice the global average rate, even more in the north and on the prairies. Some of that is from natural factors, but the report concludes that most is from human activity, mainly burning fossil fuels and destroying carbon sinks like forests and wetlands. Okay. You say, so what? Well, so what? Listen to that again. Listen to what he said in there. Buried in that little paragraph was this, that this is happening in the major area where they grow their food. That is important. All right? So if you look at Canada and it's warming twice as fast as any place else, it's the prairies. And those prairies where you have your great fruit orchards going to the east of Canada, and then you've got your grain belt, that means that one of the largest exporters of grain around the world, they're not going to be able to do that, because once you heat up the soil, the seeds don't germinate, and they're going to have a lot of failing crop. So again, we're not paying attention to basics, but here are my top 10 reasons why I believe that at this moment, now I'm hopeful I'm wrong and it changes, but at this moment, I believe that there is no positive outcome in the United States and other countries for the future. I believe that we have, in effect, stopped even pretending that we care. The countries that are most polluting in the world who will not reverse their polluting and can't, China is the largest emitter of carbon dioxide in the world. According to the Global Carbon Project, China emits 27% of all global emissions. The United States were second with 14% of global emissions. And European Union, 9.6. India is at 6.6. Russia is at far less, 5%. But Japan is at 3%. Brazil is at 2.3%. Indonesia, Canada, Mexico, each at 1.7%. Iran is at 1.6. South Korea, 1.5. And Australia, 1.3. Now, which of these countries is willing to do the following? Stop growing. Stop urbanization. Cut off the meat and educate people to why they should be going plant-based and doing it as a national directive. Now, China could do that if it chose to, but it's still eating monkeys and kittens and dogs and anything that moves, it'll eat. And there's not even a conscious effort to change. And why would there be? Think their mindset. They have the largest prison in the world, even larger than Israel's prison of Gaza. And they have over a Muslim people in this prison. Have you heard a word of criticism about this? No, not officially. So they're not going to change. And they're building the world's largest city, which will be over 400 million people. The first leg of that is 140 million people, and it's almost done. This is all going to be completed in the next 5 to 10 years. And so it's going to require an enormous amount of energy. And we had a 3.2% increase in carbon dioxide last year. So we're just at 1.5. What we said 10 years ago, we cannot pass 1.5. We're at it right now. So we're not just going to pass it. We're going to leap over that. So then you look, okay, so European Union isn't going to change. The United States sure as hell is not going to change. And here's why. Because we have corporate pushback and lobbying efforts, because nobody wants to have their stock value go down because the corporate earnings are not going to go to the shareholders. They're going to go back into defossilizing their energy sources. That will take them at least 10 to 15 years, and there's no one volunteering to do it. And they have captured all the agencies. Then you have the government agencies itself, the EPA, Department of Energy, the Treasury, even Commerce Department. All of these are captured by and run by technocrats and policy supervisors from major think tanks and representing corporate interest. Then you have the media bias. On the Fox and the others, you have conservative bias, and the liberal media have liberal bias. But both of them are ultimately controlled by similar groups. They're not saying we demand now a Marshall Plan for environmental action. Both sides are pushing nuclear. Bad, and I told you why earlier. Also, big agriculture and the monoculture is not going to change to allow sustainable organic small farms to exist. Look how long it took them for the first hemp farm to exist in the United States. That would have saved us from having to cut down 90 trees for what one hemp would have given us. You're not changing meat. Only 2.6% of the American population are vegan. Only 7% are vegetarian, which means that 97% of the American population every day are eating the very foods that are contributing to global warming, and they're not going to stop. Then you have to look at time is not on our side. The environment and the 44 feedback loops are not and tipping points are not going to stop because we haven't come to a decision yet what to do. Also, we're a nation living what I call the illusion delusion. There was 1.2 million school children who protested and went out on strike at their school for a day to show they were concerned about global warming. We had 2,000 children in the United States do the same. I filmed one of them in at the UN, and she had all of two supporters there. We are the problem, and we're not going to change. So it's not just China, India, Brazil, and the United States and Russia that are not going to change because they don't want to diminish their power by diminishing people's lifestyles and standards. It's just that we want to see something changed, but our professional class, that's 71 to 80 million professional scientists, lawyers, doctors, engineers, CEOs, educated people, they have addicted themselves to more. The concept of post-World War II, Great Depression, austerity, use what you have, appreciate what you have, and don't always envy what you don't, that's gone. That generation is the senior generation. We, the baby boomers, who had the privilege of being taught by these people proper principles of ethics, culture, manners, the value of things, not just the cost of things, we're dying, and the younger generation has, with some exceptions, has none of those virtues. They're either apathetic, feeling, help me, Google, and or they don't care. So where, with their children and families being almost two-thirds the entire American population, forget 1%, 2%, two-thirds of American population, who exactly are going to be the policymakers and opinion leaders asking for change and then having the political will to see that it's done and the economic resources do it intelligently and not be captured by those who are now using the green movement for profit only, just like a person making $250,000 running a charity for the poor. Is there something obscene about that? Yeah. Let's go over to my guest who's standing by now. Let's say hello to, I gave his bio earlier, Joe Luria. Nice to have you with us today, Joe. Hi, Joe. Are you there? No? Okay. Well, what we're going to do then, we're
Gary,
going to
I'm
go...
here. Sorry, Gary.
Oh, hi,
Hello.
Joe.
Hello. I'm here. How are you? Night.
Your mic was muted. Joe, I know that you know Julian Assange and WikiLeaks publishing Afghanistan and Iraq war logs and secret diplomatic cables and from former American intelligence analyst Chelsea Manning. And according to the charging document, Assange allegedly agreed to assist Manning in cracking a password to a classified government computer in March 2010. It's unclear whether the hacking effort was successful. But Assange allegedly egged on Manning to provide additional information. The U.S. military prosecutors argue that Manning's leak provided intelligence to Al-Qaeda and other Islamic militants groups. Would you address this, and also would you address the idea that the United States through the CIA and its other intelligence operatives have been funding many of these terrorist groups in the Middle East, especially in Libya and Syria and Iraq, So our hands are not clean when it comes to the support that the terrorist groups have received. That's just as an aside. But take us on this journey to give us your insight, please.
Yes, thank you. A key thing to understand is the nature of the Espionage Act and why the U.S. government, even the Trump administration, is trying to avoid, it appears, to charge Assange under a section of that act which criminalizes publishing. We don't have an official Secrets Act in the U.S. as they do in Britain, but we come pretty close with this Section E of the Espionage Act, which says that anyone who possesses and or disseminates classified information is liable to be prosecuted under the act for espionage. Of course, Assange certainly possessed classified information and he published it. That is such an absurd part of the act that anyone who retweets an article from WikiLeaks or a document from WikiLeaks could theoretically also be charged under the act because they are now possessing classified information and disseminating it. When a document comes out and leaked like this, the government doesn't declassify it. In their view, it's still classified even if the public can read it. So the government, the Department of Justice, trying to avoid indicting Assange on that idea and that section because that would open up the prosecution for other publications like the New York Times or the Washington Post, which, of course, all the time publish classified information. Very often that leaked by government itself to serve government interests, but not always. So they would like to avoid what the Obama administration called their New York Times problem. They also looked into indicting Assange, and they backed off in the end because of this issue, which they did not want to open up the prosecution towards the friendly establishment media. So they tried to get him on this technicality so far. The indictment that was finally unsealed yesterday was, as you said, simply an allegation that Assange assisted Chelsea Manning in cracking a password to allow her to get documents that would be sent to WikiLeaks to be published. Now, this is only an allegation, and it's pretty flimsy at that. But it may have been intended, this very weak and narrow indictment, to facilitate the extradition of Assange to the United States. There's a law that Britain must have a law against this, as well as the U.S. In other words, you want somebody extradited, that the country you want the person extradited from must have a law that's similar to your law. So they will have had to have broken the law in both places. I'm not sure about the computer fraud acts in the U.K., but it seems likely that that's the case, that it would be a crime in Britain as well to have assisted someone in hacking something or getting access to documents. Again, this is not proven, and it's very narrow because they want to use this for the extradition of Assange to the U.S. Many people have said, and the Department of Justice itself said yesterday, that there will be new charges that they're working on against Assange for a superseding indictment that would replace this one. There is another restriction. I don't want to get too legal here, but it's called the rule of speciality, and that means that Assange can only be indicted or charged and prosecuted in the U.S. for the very crimes that he was extradited for. So they would have to come up with these new rules or these new charges before he's extradited, unless the U.S. and the U.K. could find some loopholes to get out of that. So where we stand now is, of course, he was dragged out of the embassy yesterday in full view of the cameras at 10:30 a.m. in broad daylight. Not at all a secret way of spiriting him out of the back door. They wanted the world to see they got their man. And what man did they get? The man who exposed crimes and abuse of governments around the world, principally of the United States. We are, in this whole media discussion going on, we are not talking about what WikiLeaks has revealed over the years, particularly in the Manning leaks. And that was evidence of prima facie evidence of war crimes by the United States. The video called Collateral Murder, which is 15 or so minutes long. It's very difficult to look at. It's the black and white footage from the cockpit of the Black Hawk helicopters hovering above this scene in a street in Baghdad, in which they murder a couple of Reuters journalists. And then a family is attacked that came to try to bring these men to the hospital. And the worst part, of course, is the pilot's audio, where you could hear them laughing about this. Absolute sociopaths. And those guys are walking free today. plus the offices that ordered them to do this, plus the high-level officials that started this invasion of Iraq, which was totally illegal. There was no authorization of the Security Council. There was no right of self-defense by the U.S. The U.S. was not being attacked by Iraq. So these men, including Blair and Bush and Cheney and Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld and those pilots, are free today, while we saw this man, a journalist, a publisher, who revealed their crimes, being dragged out on a technicality that he helped his source to maybe get access to this damning information. And also he's charged in this indictment, unbelievably, for trying to protect his source by eliminating some communications and changing metadata so that the officials could not discover that Manning was the source. That, by protecting a source, they're criminalizing protecting sources. They're criminalizing helping sources to get information. And all journalists are always egging on their sources to give them more and finding ways to get more. This is where we're at right now, Gary. We've got this man as a publisher, and he revealed their crimes, and that's why they needed to get him, because they have to stop him and WikiLeaks from revealing more crimes so they can continue to rule in impunity around the world.
Joe, I believe that there's also another ulterior motive. Part of it is from that permanent state, the people who stay behind. And I believe that a lot of this has to do with WikiLeaks exposing John Podesta's emails concerning Hillary Clinton and what they were engaged in, including the unethical and immoral, I don't know how illegal it was, removing Bernie Sanders, who would have been the Democratic nomination and easily would have beaten Trump. And that came out. Could you discuss that part of this? Who's really benefiting in the deep state of the national security agencies, along with the Clintons on this?
Yeah, well, that's another example of where, when the emails came out that revealed that corruption in the Clinton campaign, and that they didn't deal and deal, they worked to stop Bernie from getting the nomination. That was clearly evident in these emails. What happened? The conversation was changed to Russia. That somehow Russia was behind this, and Assange is a puppet of Russia, except anything but to talk about what the emails contained. Now, I wrote a book called How I Lost by Hillary Clinton, and Julian Assange wrote the foreword, and that's an analysis of those emails to try to correct this. This is where the focus has to be on. What did the emails say? What do the videos of American war crimes show? No, it's all about Assange and the demonization of this individual, the smearing of him, and have to get him. And it's simply to stop him and WikiLeaks from doing this some more. Now, the intelligence agencies have been against him from the very beginning. And we have to point out very clearly that this indictment and probably subsequent ones have nothing to do with the 2016 election. As much as Democratic loyalists and Clintonistas want to feel that way, they got their man. This has nothing to do with that. It goes back to the Chelsea Manning era of the Afghan and Iraq war logs and the State Department cables. Now, the intelligence agencies have a bipartisan, even nonpartisan hatred for this guy and for anyone who would dare to reveal their methods and what they're doing around the world and the crimes that they commit. So they've wanted to get him all along. We have seen a partisan aspect from the press. When he revealed George Bush's crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan, the liberal media published it and celebrated it. Assange, he won awards around the world for journalism, even from The Economist magazine. But when he turned his attention, because he got those emails from a source on Clinton, then they vilified him. But the intelligence agencies have hated him all along, in particular the Vault 7 release by WikiLeaks of a couple of years ago, which really blew the cover on a whole electronic spying operation by the CIA, a huge, vast trove of documents that showed how they can look through their televisions and record what you're doing in your home, and take over cars and make them speed up. And also, they've created over many years and billions of dollars. It took them to create this system where if somebody, they could put fingerprints in a hack to make it look like someone else did the hacking. And that was, some people say that that's what they did to try to pin this on Russia, the hack of the DNC computers. So Assange has been a special target of the intelligence agencies and throughout this period, but of the Democrats, certainly since the 2016 election, because they blame him and Russia for Clinton's loss rather than Clinton. And That's the problem here. It's not a partisan issue for the intelligence agencies. It is for the Democrats. But these indictments that we saw, the indictment yesterday, has nothing to do with the 2016 election. Just an excuse to get him, this technical issue of whether he helped Manning get through a password or not.
Joe Loria, thank you very much for coming on and giving us your insights on this. I was going to play a clip from Glenn Greenwald. I will do that on Monday. And Joe's book is How I Lost and Goldman Sachs Won by Hillary Clinton. And he is at consortiumnews.com. We really respect all the good work you're doing over there, and we look forward to another conversation.
Well, thank you so much, Gary.
I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on our next program, and have a nice day, everyone.
You never close your eyes anymore when I kiss your lips. And there's no tenderness like before in your fingertips. You're trying hard not to show it, but baby,